This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 25 years of service, Ron Kapp saw plenty of action. As a soldier, an Army officer, and then a foreign service officer documenting war crimes, he's worked in some of the world's deadliest places. From the horrors of genocide to daily deprivations in Kosovo, Central Africa, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Darfur, Kapp's experienced 5 wars in 10 years. He was haunted by his inability to stop the killing of civilians and plunged into depression. His marriage, his career, and his mental health unraveled. And Kapp found himself with a loaded pistol in the back of a pickup truck in a Sudanese desert, ready to end it all.
The clarity passed, and I was overwhelmed with a sense of futility and sadness. I had failed to stop the wars. So many people were dead because of my failures. The images were rushing at me, the 45 dead from Rachak, the raped nun from Bunia, the man with the red-rimmed eyes and his mutilated family near Sinek. I picked up the pistol and charged it, loading a bullet into the firing chamber. My hands were shaking. I put the beer down. I took the pistol off safe. I was sobbing and talking to myself, to the spheres, to no one. The pistol was ready. I shifted it to my left hand. I looked at it in my hand, lying partly on my lap and down a bit. I took a deep breath to calm myself. I was ready. Then the phone rang.
That phone call saved his life. He got help and has helped countless others as founder of the Veterans Writing Project. Ron Kapps wrote a memoir of that time called Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years. He talked to us about it when it was published last April. Well, that phone call did save you. It was your then-wife, Maureen, and you were medevaced out at your own request. Eventually back to D.C. with an office job. Talk about living in D.C. There was a point when you overreached, thinking that you could go see the Washington Nationals play. What was going on with you then?
Well, like you said, I was just back from my 5th war and a suicide attempt. I was newly divorced. My mom had just died. I was completely overwhelmed with everything going on in my life, and I wasn't taking care of myself. All of this PTSD in my life, all of that had to do with the fact that I didn't take care of myself. I just kept deploying and deploying and deploying without sufficient time at home to decompress, to reprogram. And when I got to Washington, I was surprised that even having been medically evacuated, even having been sent home, no one really seemed to want to follow up with medical care. No one stopped me and said, hey, you have to go get this medical treatment. I was just assigned to this office full of introverts and sat quietly doing my reading and my writing and my briefings of senior officials. And I was trying to get better on my own. Mm-hmm. I eventually sought medical care. But in that interim period, you know, the incident you talk about, I lived on Capitol Hill, not too far from where the Nationals played. So I walked down there one day to see a game. And this was at the old RFK Stadium that was one of those 70s venues where they would try and do any possible type of event from concerts to football games to baseball games. And it just had this huge area up at the very top. Well, I'd bought tickets to sit down near the field, but as I was walking down the aisle, I just realized that it was all too much. There was just far, far too much going on, and I couldn't focus, and the anxiety just began to rise in me. So rather than just running away, I decided I would try and stay in the game, but I found a nice quiet place way up on the third deck where the other misanthropes were. And we all sat quietly by ourselves, together, alone, way up on top.
Well, that's a question. I mean, we hear a lot about the military shunning or looking down upon admissions of mental illness, you know, perceived as weakness or whatever. What did asking for help mean for you, an intelligence officer and an Army officer?
Well, at that point, what I thought asking for help would mean was that I feared I would lose my security clearance, which meant I would have lost my job because I could not work without a security clearance. But I also feared I was in a unit that was an airborne unit. So I'm surrounded by paratroopers, surrounded by Rangers. And I thought that my peers would look upon me as being weak, as being broken, that I couldn't hold up, that I couldn't take the stress, that I couldn't take all the things that I was doing, when in fact it was all the things that I had done that was catching up with me.
You just said the things that you had done, but it's sometimes the things that you hadn't done that is really kind of haunting you. And I'm talking about these because I read in your book that it is important to talk about them communally. If you wish to or you're able to, do you want to share an experience that overcame you until you overcame it?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's sort of what this book is all about, is getting control of those memories and showing others that it is possible to do so. I mean, one of the events that will always haunt me was in a little town called Senec, and it was in either late August or early September of 1998 during the insurgency in Kosovo. And we went into this village called Senec because the Serbs had come through the day before and there were civilians killed. And so my team drove up to this village and we went to watch as some civilian Kosovars were burying the dead from the Serbian attack the day before. So we had to verify that these people were dead, what had happened, and that's relatively standard work. But as we were leaving, a crowd surrounded our vehicle, and I got out of the truck to talk to them, to hear what they had to say, and my translator was standing beside me, and this woman pushes her way through the crowd and holds her infant child out at arm's length, pointing the child at me. And my translator says, she wants you to take her baby away so the Serbs won't kill him. And I knew I couldn't do this because to relocate civilians, we could have lost our status in country and we would then have been no help to anyone. And so I felt like I was hiding behind this bureaucracy, and that will always haunt me. And that action not taken is one of the things that gets at what Jonathan Shea and Brett Litz do at the Boston VA hospital in their research on what are called moral injuries. Mm-hmm. And it's some action that a person takes or fails to take or even witnesses that transgresses closely held personal beliefs and moral beliefs. And I knew, of course, that the right thing to do would be say, okay, I'm going to take your child with us and give this child protection, to take that child in my arms. But diplomatically, politically, professionally, I knew that to do so would mean I would be put out of the country and perhaps my entire team. But I also have to add here that one of the other internationals, I think someone from the UN High Commission for Refugees, did come back that evening, and as is part of their charter, their authorization in country, they were allowed to do this sort of thing. And so they did relocate some of the children to a safer village.
We're talking with Ron Capps. He was a career Army and Foreign Service when PTSD knocked him off track. He got to the other side by writing, among other things, and is founder of the Veterans Writing Workshop. His new book is called Seriously All Right. Well, Ron Capps, you had fallen apart in the past, over drinks with another officer in Senec, remembering this experience with this child and the slaughtered families and a Serb officer with a gun to his head in another incident. And you write, this is the last time I let myself publicly go. So is this book letting yourself go publicly?
Well, I think it is in many ways. The night that you referenced, one of my colleagues came in to the room where I was staying and was doing this writing at night, and I just fell apart. I was crying, and I'm sure it was a terribly embarrassing moment for my colleague. But I never let go of my emotions in front of another colleague. Now that I'm retired, this story, the important part of this story is the story of hope, that there's a road home, that people can find this road. And if writing is what works for people, that's fabulous. If it's art, dance, music, drama, traditional therapies, acupuncture, whatever it is, if there's a road home, go find it. And that's the hopeful part of the story. But that hopeful part doesn't really make sense without telling the how I got out to that point in the desert. So I am letting go of it. It is sort of a type of therapy for me to just allow these stories to be told. But what I really want people to understand is that there is a road home, and you can see what happened to me. Much worse things have happened to others, but this is my story, and here's how I came home. Maybe you can find your own way.
And for you, in coping with your PTSD, took a what you call a journey through Prozacistan, tried drinking too much, tried talk therapy, a number of typical ways to do it, dug deeper into the nature of this returning soldier, leading you to your own writing. Now, how is that connected for you?
Well, when I came back from my service overseas, I was clearly not all right, and I needed help. So I sought medical care with a psychiatrist. I was given medications. We tried different rounds, different combinations, different cocktails of medications. I was doing talk therapy. We were trying all sorts of things, and maybe my expectations were too high, but I didn't feel as if I was getting well enough, fast enough. And whether we changed the drug or we went to a different type of therapy, nothing really seemed to me to be working. Until I realized that the writing I had done in country, in theater, and the writing I continued to do at home seemed to be helping me. So just let me give a little bit of background here. My job as an intelligence officer, or my job as a State Department political officer, was to go to some foreign country, get on the ground, learn as much as I could about the culture, the society, the people, their grievances, their desires, their needs. What's the history of this rebellion? How did it form? How can we try to solve it? And then write about that to a readership back in Washington, whether at the State Department or the Pentagon. And so I would go out into these areas and come back and write these relatively crisp, dry reports about what quite often were messy, horrible acts of cruelty. And even when I was in theater, I knew that this wasn't enough. I knew I had to capture more of this. So when I finished my work for the day, I would go back to my tent or to my room, wherever it was, and I would sit down and I would continue to write. And I would write the whole story. I would write about the look on that woman's face rather than the fact that there had been 8 killed in that village. Mm-hmm. There had been 11 wounded, with one being a 72-year-old man. Just the facts in those government reports. I wrote more about it. I wrote more about what it felt like, about what their looks said to me. And so I did this for 10 years. When I came home, I still had all of this writing, and I started going through all of that writing and editing it and just rewriting everything until those memories were no longer able to take control of me. I put up a little sign in the attic that I use as my office, and it says, either you control the memory or the memory controls you. And that's what I did. I wrote until I controlled the memories. And all of that writing is what became this book.
Can you control the memories, Ron Capps?
I think there are some memories that I may never fully control, because there are some things that I haven't just been able to get to yet. I have not written about. I know they're still out there. I know they're still in my head. But when I need to write about them, I will. But I would say that I have gotten control of the things. I've gotten control of the dead who came to talk to me at night. They no longer control me.
Ron Capps, I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Ron Capps, his new book is called Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years. It's his account of the horrors that led to his diagnosis of PTSD and how he coped with it and how he became the founder of the Veterans Writing Project. For more on the book and to read works by veterans on the ODARK 30 blog, you'll find links at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter at wordofmouth. From the bow and arrow to the unmanned drone, the weapons of war have evolved significantly. But one tool has persisted for centuries: music. The not-so-sweet sounds of psychological warfare, when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since trumpets brought down the walls of Jericho, music has been part of the war narrative. And the playlist has gone far beyond the fife and drum corps of the American Revolution. From Scottish bagpipes to Metallica, Aaron Henkin takes us on a short tour through the history of music as a weapon.
The date is September 21st, 1745. You're a British soldier under the command of a confident General Cope in Edinburgh at Dunbar. You've been told to expect an impending clash with an unspecified number of Scottish Jacobite rebels. You can see nothing through the thick and disorienting fog. And suddenly, from nowhere and everywhere at once, your senses are assaulted by a blood-curdling wail, a relentless and unbearable sonic blast that envelops you and your fellow troops from seemingly all directions. Within 15 minutes, you and your fellow soldiers have lost your will to fight. You retreat as fast as your feet will carry you, and the battlefield is cleared. Within the year, the British government has classified the bagpipe as a weapon of war, unilaterally banned possession of the instrument, and declared that pipers can and should be tried in the same legal manner as those who carry conventional weapons. Fast forward 2.5 centuries. It's June 21st, 2004, in Iraq. American troops are conducting a large-scale morning raid in the western city of Ramadi. A line of approaching Humvees kicks up a wall of dust on the flat horizon. The U.S. battalion announces its arrival with the aid of roof-mounted public address speakers. In a military tip of the hat to the Francis Ford Coppola film Apocalypse Now, Iraqis on this morning are greeted with a high-volume assault of Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries. The raid is successful, and now it's a few months later. You're an Iraqi prisoner of war in an unspecified U.S. detention and interrogation facility. The BBC reports that you've been hooded and forced to stand facing a wall for 8 days straight, and that during the course of your interrogation, you've been subjected to high-volume 24-hour doses of the heavy metal band Metallica. U.S. Sergeant Mark Habsel explains, "These people haven't heard heavy metal before. They can't take it. If you play it for 24 hours, your brain and body functions start to slide. Your train of thought slows down, and your will is broken." That's when we come in and talk to them. Now rewind 11 years and transport yourself to Waco, Texas. You're a Branch Davidian, holed up in the Mount Carmel compound of apocalyptic cult leader David Koresh. A small army of federal agents has surrounded you with 100-watt amplifiers and public address speakers. Through the barricaded doors and boarded-up windows of the compound, you hear an ear-splitting but unidentifiable sound. After what seems like hours, the chanting of Tibetan monks bleeds into a Christmas carol. And then a Muslim prayer call. Then an Alice Cooper song. Then Nancy Sinatra. And all the while, this inscrutable playlist is being peppered with the looped sounds of sirens, babies crying, ticking clocks, dental drills, and telephone busy signals. The prolonged sonic barrage has a palpable effect. Nearby cattle herds are reported to stampede, and one of the Branch Davidians, a young mother, ceases lactating.
You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing.
Ironically, Nancy Sinatra's now infamous song includes the cryptic lyrics, "You keep thinking that you'll never get burned, but I just found me a brand new box of matches." The ultimate and controversial result of the Waco standoff, a fire that left 75 Branch Davidians dead, has since left the world scratching its head and wondering, among other things, about just how and whether we ought to attempt to harness the power of sound as a weapon.
Are you ready, Boots? Start walking.
And that story came to us from Aaron Henkin. In times of conflict, multiple military deployments are common and can last upwards of 12 months. How one mother of three small children dealt with her husband's prolonged absences by asking guests to fill his empty seat at the dinner table once a week. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dinner is tough for military families. During deployments, the empty seat at the table makes their absence visible. Sarah Smiley and her three young sons faced that nightly void back in December of 2011 when Navy pilot Dustin Smiley left for 13 months in Djibouti, Africa. So they decided to fill it. Each week, they asked guests to join them for a casual dinner. First up was Senator Susan Collins. 53 weeks later, they dined with neighbors, school teachers, artists, politicians, sports stars, and R2-D2. Through those meals, the Smileys survived holidays, a flooded basement, a lost wedding ring, and the daily challenges of playing single mom to three boys. They also built a community of friends they would not have known otherwise. Sarah Smiley is a syndicated newspaper columnist, and her new book is called Dinner with the Smileys. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So how old were your boys when Dustin first left for that year?
Let's see. Our youngest was 4, and our oldest, my husband left the day before our oldest's 11th birthday, and the week of Thanksgiving. And then just a few days later, our middle son turned 9.
So that's a bit of a sting. Two big birthdays that your husband wasn't around for
in a holiday. But, you know, it's interesting. Military families, a lot of people say that, how many birthdays did he miss? How many anniversaries? And those certainly are difficult times. But you find at the end of the deployment that the worst times were the ordinary days.
Yeah. And you write a lot about those ordinary days. And you let us know from the jump that you don't like to cook, you don't like small talk.
No.
So having dinner guests once a week was actually your idea initially, but then you kind of pushed it off the burner and it got pushed forward a little to make it happen. How did it happen?
Right. Dinner time's always been really important to us, and we always sit down, the five of us, at the dinner table. And I knew from my husband's previous deployments that that's the hardest time to have him gone. So I knew that. And at one of the last dinners before my husband deployed, one of the boys said, "It'll be strange not to have dad at the dinner table." So I just reacted to that, already anxious about it. And I said, "Well, we won't leave his seat empty. We'll invite people." But I meant we'll invite their friends. We'll have my friends over, our neighbors. I certainly didn't think it would turn into what it did turn into. But it snowballed with the boys. They started saying, could we invite a policeman? Could we invite our teachers? Could we, you know, just kept going and going. But my husband was really worried about us being in Maine. Would we be forgotten? Would people really understand what we were going through? So he was the one that said, "I really do hope you'll invite people over because I want you to stay connected to the community and don't isolate yourself. Reach out for help."
Mm-hmm. And your son, Ford, your oldest son, wrote to Senator Collins and she came.
She did, yes. She was the first person that Ford wanted to invite. His letter was awesome because he said, "My name's Ford Smiley. These are, you know, I have a mom and a dad." It was just very cute, like fifth grader, I think he was when he wrote that. And I thought, no way is she going to be able to have time to come. But I thought it was a good exercise for him to learn how to write a formal letter, how to reach out to your representatives. And then sure enough, 2 weeks later, I got a call from Washington, D.C. that said, that the office nearly cried when they read Ford's letter and that Senator Collins would be honored to come sit in his seat. And what I said was, oh, great. But inside I was thinking, oh, no, what did I do? Because I don't even own linens. You know, I gave Senator Collins a paper towel to put in her lap as a napkin. I was totally unprepared and I don't cook. But very quickly I learned that when you invite people to your house, they're not coming for a four-star meal. If they wanted that, they'd go to a restaurant. They're not coming for a Martha Stewart home tour. If they wanted that, they'd go to a tour of homes. When they accept an invitation to come to your house, it's because they want to get to know you.
Well, you sometimes did eat out in restaurants.
We did.
You ate at the, well, the place where the governor lives, the Blaine House.
The Blaine House.
Restaurants, a bookstore, mm-hmm. Mount Katahdin.
Yeah.
Once. Is there any dinner of these 52 that stands out for you as the most memorable?
Actually, the one, when I started out, I didn't think I would write a book, but I knew I would write some of my columns about it. When I knew I would write a book, in fact, the very first chapter I wrote was chapter 6, and it was after dinner number 17, we were supposed to have dinner with my elderly neighbor who had gone to assisted living. I kept pushing off the dinner because we had other guests that had pressing schedules, and I felt like Gloria wasn't going anywhere. So we had scheduled it for April, and I called the assisted living facility just to make sure everything was set up for our visit. And I found out that she had passed away about 2 weeks or a week before we were going to come. And I asked the boys what they wanted to do because they didn't want to replace her dinner. And they said, that they wanted to go to the assisted living facility anyways and eat with her friends and neighbors. So we ended up sitting with a man and his wife who had Alzheimer's. And at that dinner, the man started to get very emotional and told me that he had been reading my columns about being lonely at dinner and that he understood because even though he had never deployed or anything, and he had had his wife for, I think they'd been married 60 years, that for the last 2 to 3 years, he had eaten alone because she had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. That's when it struck me that this story, what we were going through, wasn't really about the military. It wasn't really about our family. And so right then I came home and I wrote that chapter and I knew that this was a bigger story that I wanted to share with the world to inspire people to reach out to someone and ask them to dinner.
And that was Frank and Anita were their
names?
Frank
and Anita,
that's what
yeah.
I'm remembering. The Katahdin dinner that I did mention, dinner number 35.
Yeah.
Which it seemed like a real watershed for you and your eldest son, mm-hmm. Ford. And now he seemed to take your husband's absence the hardest. How did you handle that?
Yes, he was very bitter in the beginning.
He was 11, wasn't he?
11, yeah. And just kind of on that cusp of pre-adolescence and a lot of emotions going on and a lot of slamming doors saying he hated me, wished I was on deployment instead of dad. But through the year, I felt like Ford and I became much closer during that time. He grew up. He really took on the role of helping to take care of his brothers. And the Mount Katahdin trip, he really fought me on that. He didn't want to go. He thought it was a waste of time. It was going to be too long. But he loved it, and I loved the experience. And it was kind of a bonding moment for the two of us. So was also the dinner where we went and put flags on the veterans' graves with Congressman Michaud from Maine. And my son Ford and I went off together as a team. And the people who were handing out the flags to us gave us specific instructions, and they said, each service member gets a flag. And I asked the question, their spouses too? And they said, no, only the service members. And I knew what they meant because then they might run out of flags. But I told Ford, come on, you and I are going to go do this set of flags. And when I walked away, Ford said, we're going to go put flags on the spouses' graves, aren't we? And I said, yes. But we put them in between the spouse and the service member. So that was kind of a bonding moment too.
Sarah Smiley is with us. She's been called the Irma Bombeck for the military set, and we're talking about her family's experience having guests for dinner for the year that her husband was deployed abroad. It's a story told in her book, Dinner with the Smileys. Well, Sarah, it's amazing reading about what you do. You're working on your master's. Mm-hmm. You're teaching journalism at the University of Maine. Raising these three kids by yourself, I mean, did you ever just get exhausted and dread the idea of, oh, God, I'm going to have another dinner that I have to get together this week?
I did. There were lots of times that I wanted to cancel. But very quickly, the dinners kind of became life rafts for us. It's very hard to think about having your spouse gone for a year. But when you can take it week by week, it's kind of the day by day mentality. It made it that much easier. And so I put my focus on the dinners. You know, if I can just get to this next dinner, then I only have that many more weeks until he comes home. But there were plenty of times that I thought, I have nothing to cook. And as you know, in the book, I cooked lasagna for about 90% of the dinners. And sometimes I went into the dinners already defeated and tired and thinking, this isn't going to be good. This is a train wreck. Sometimes I thought our guests would be boring. You know, I thought, I don't know how I'm going to make this dinner exciting for the boys. But it never happened. Every single dinner showed us something different, whether we learned something, whether it was funny, whether it was surprising, challenging, emotional. And I always ended the dinners feeling refreshed, energized, and glad that I did it.
And your boys sort of hold their own with the guests. That's kind of amazing to watch. You know, they're picking up for each other. There's a kind of loyalty and cheering on of each other. You know, there's a little bickering as well. They are three boys, after all. What do you think is possible, Sarah, around a dinner table that just doesn't happen elsewhere?
I think it's the great equalizer, sitting down to the dinner table. We had a lot of high-profile people like senators and congressmen, mayors and governors. But it didn't matter what their title was or what their status was. When they sat down at our dinner table and we were passing them the ketchup or the Parmesan cheese or whatever it was hard to think of them as anything else but entirely human. And I feel like we bonded with people over the dinner table in ways that we couldn't have if we hadn't sat down to dinner. Mm. And in fact, when we had our dinner with Governor LePage, who is not very popular in our
Paul
state,
LePage,
yes,
okay.
Who's not very popular in our state, I got a lot of pushback from people saying they couldn't believe I would go to have dinner with him. And so I wrote a column about it, addressing that through the boys' eyes to them, he was just a man to come have dinner with. They knew he was the governor. They respected that. But he was a human being. And they judged him on a different level than through politics. They thought that was one of their favorite dinners because he played hide-and-go-seek in the Blaine house. They served chicken tenders and ketchup. And they didn't care what his politics were. And they taught me through that we should judge people on who they are, not their job or their title.
Well, Dustin does return. I mean, I was blubbering at the end of the book at his return, which is not only a reason to be glad to have him back, but maybe on some level to think, oh, God, I don't have to do these dinners anymore. But you've kept it up.
Kept it up. Well, because it's kind of become part of our culture now. And, you know, I mentioned that we had some high profile guests. But what I like to tell people who have wanted to maybe do the same sort of thing, or not every week, but, you know, reach out and invite someone, is that the most memorable moving dinners we had were with people whose names you won't know until you read the book. They weren't the high-profile people. Mm-hmm. They certainly were memorable dinners, but just this experience of the community and people that we got to know, that's kind of become part of the boys' world. So even when Dustin came home, the boys kept it going. They said, well, if it had been a while that it had just been the five of us at the table, they'd say, when are we going to invite someone to dinner?
Thank you so much speaking with us.
Thanks.
Sarah Smiley, a syndicated newspaper columnist, journalism teacher, and author of Dinner with the Smileys, One Military Family, One Year of Heroes, and Lessons for a Lifetime. Sarah's giving readings throughout New England, including the Perfect Wife restaurant in Manchester, Vermont, on Saturday. There's much more at her website, and we've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And Word of Mouth continues with Phil Klei. He's a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who served in Iraq. We're going to talk with him about his debut collection of short stories. It's called Redeployment. It's been nominated for a National Book Award. That conversation when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For people who've experienced armed conflict, no aspect of life remains unchanged. Intimacy, getting a good night's sleep, even a trip to the mall. Here's author Phil Klei, reading from his collection of short stories about life in and after combat. Here, a Marine comes home to North Carolina after 7 months in Iraq.
So here's an experience. Your wife takes you shopping in Wilmington. Last time you walked down a city street, your Marine on point went down the side of the road, checking ahead and scanning the roofs across from him. The Marine behind him checks the windows on the top levels of the buildings. The Marine behind him gets the windows a little lower, and so on down until your guys have the street level covered, and the Marine in back has the rear. In a city, there's a million places they can kill you from. It freaks you out at first, but you go through like you were trained, and it works. In Wilmington, you don't have a squad. You don't have a battle buddy. You don't even have a weapon. You startle 10 times checking for it, and it's not there. You're safe, so your alertness level should be at white, but it's not. Instead, you're stuck in an American Eagle Outfitters. Your wife gives you some clothes to try on, and you walk into the tiny dressing room. You close the door, and you don't want to open it again. Outside, there are people walking around by the windows like it's no big deal. People have no idea where Fallujah is, where 3 members of your platoon died. People who've spent their whole lives at white. They'll never get even close to orange. You can't, until the first time you're in a firefight or the first time an IED goes off that you missed and you realize that everybody's life, everybody's, depends on you not screwing up. And you depend on them.
Phil Klei is a writer and veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who served 13 months in Iraq. His debut collection of stories is called Redeployment and has been nearly universally praised for, as the New York Times Sunday Book Review put it, capturing the ways the conflict splintered the psyches of the men who fought it. It was recently nominated for a National Book Award, and Phil Klei spoke to us about his book when it was released in March. You attended Dartmouth College here in New Hampshire. You then joined the Marines, served in Anbar Province for a year, moved to New York City, got your MFA from Hunter. When in that process did you start writing these stories?
I started the first story in 2008, not that long after I got back from Iraq. I think you come back from going overseas, and there's just a lot of questions in your head, a lot of memories that you want to work through and think about, and experiences of that either you had or that people that you knew had. And I think writing the stories was, and writing that first story in particular, was my entry point into thinking about these questions more deeply.
Is that why you wrote them in the first person? It's as if you were putting a little buffer between yourself and the stories.
Well, you know, I wanted to have a range of perspectives. It was very important to me to do that. I didn't want to come back and write the sort of, you know, this is how it was, I was there book. And I have nothing against those books, but just Iraq is such a, it was such an incredibly complicated range of experiences for the people who serve there. And, you know, everybody goes and they have what they went through, and then they come back and they think about it in different ways, and they interpret it through, you know, through their experiences and the ideas that they've had. And I wanted to have all these different narrators who, in one sense, they'd give you a kind of composite view of the war, but also who would argue against each other. I thought that was very important for allowing the reader to kind of, you know, look at these different experiences and the different claims that these narrators are making, and then, you know, kind of critically engage with it.
Yeah, we do get narrators with a range of rank and age and experience and I think education in many cases.
Yes.
You were a public affairs officer in Iraq, which meant that you probably interacted with a real array of Marines and others. I'm wondering if that position as public affairs officer helped you channel the voices in your book.
Of course. I mean, it's an odd job, and I ended up, I ended up traveling through a lot of Anbar province. I ended up doing everything from, you know, going out with National Guardsmen on their way to meet with Iraqi police or do a patrol, and to sitting in on the battle update assessment briefs that went to General Odierno. And so you get a pretty wide range of interactions with a lot of people doing a lot of very different things. And that definitely went into the book, and I wanted to do justice to a lot of the different people that I had met, and just the variety and complexity of what the war meant, and also what the variety and complexity of what it meant to come home from it.
Back in 2010, you wrote an article for the New York Times, and in it you wrote, "Though I continue to tell stories about Iraq, I sometimes fear that makes me a fraud." I'd like to dig into that a little. You were there.
Sure.
You served. Was it not enough not to be seeing action in the same way many of the Marines were?
It's a complicated thing. You know, there are all these little subcultures in the Marine Corps or in the military in general. And then you know, one of the things that we think about in terms of war is as a proving ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come back, who has the right to talk about war? You know, is it the guy who's seen the most action? Is it the guy who got blown up and you know, was seriously injured? Or is it all of us? Should we all, you know, even citizens who didn't serve or didn't go overseas, should we be talking about war and critically engage with it? And ultimately, I feel that we all need to talk about these subjects. I think it's critically important that we do. But I think you need to do that with a sensitivity towards the type of experiences that you're talking about.
We're speaking with Phil Klei. He's a writer. He's a veteran of the Marine Corps, and he's the author of the book Redeployment. It's a collection of stories from the perspective of several Marines serving in and also returning from Iraq. A lot of these stories do center on soldiers returning home. Now, what was that experience like for you?
My experience was I think, a lot easier than most folks. As I said, I was a staff officer. I'd lived near a surgical facility where you'd have, you know, Marines, civilians, insurgents coming straight from the battlefield. And so you'd see, you know, you'd see things. And then I take a flight home right to New York. And I'm walking down Madison Avenue, and there's just zero sense that we're at war. It's very strange. It's very strange to be living, you know, happy, comfortable life, going to grad school, when you know that the people that you'd worked with or were friends with are deeply engaged in war and sometimes getting injured.
Yeah, so few Americans in aggregate really did experience this war. I'm trying to imagine that, what it must have been like for you. You know, there in New York City, you're in a writing program, people are sort of developing fiction, and you're thinking about, you know, stray dogs, you know, lapping up the blood of casualties on the street. I mean, what was that experience like for you? Over and over again, one of the things we hear in war stories or conversations with soldiers is that they understand something about each other that nobody else can really understand. What was that experience like for you? Did you have anyone to share it with?
I'm skeptical of that notion.
Tell me more.
You know, it's funny. Of course, there's a big disconnect. I went straight from the Marine Corps to, you know, MFA, and it's a different culture. I remember, you know, very early on, a buddy of mine, Bill Chang, sort of saying like, hey, you know, we should have lunch. And then at lunch goes, you know, Phil, maybe you should tone down the way you express things in creative writing workshop because it's a little different from the Marine Corps. But one of the things that was tremendously important for me writing the book. So I had civilian readers. I knew a bunch of guys at the NYU Veterans Writing Workshop who were very important for me writing the book and working through these ideas and reading drafts. But civilian readers were equally important, and I think that that's something that is easy to lose sight of. There are things that, because I was so focused on the veteran experience, that I had blind spots I didn't know about that civilian readers could point out to me. I think, you know, the notion that, you know, only the veteran has a voice in this conversation is really it's a really problematic notion, right? Mm-hmm. Because first off, we as a country go to war. The Marine does not issue himself orders, right? It's something that we do all together. So we're all a part of this. And then secondly, just interpersonally, I think there's a real value in talking to other people with experiences unlike yours who can offer you perspectives from a different angle that you would have never thought of. And that was crucial for me writing this book. And you know, because everybody has narratives about themselves that they'd like to believe. Veterans are no different. And, you know, you get an outside perspective, a smart, engaged, respectful but critical civilian reader or just somebody to talk to. They can offer you perspectives that are important that you never would have gotten otherwise.
Phil Klei, writer, veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, served in Iraq from 2007 to 2008. His debut book of short stories is called Redeployment. You can find a link to more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us for this special Veterans Day broadcast of Word of Mouth. If you do like what you heard, there is plenty more to listen to at wordofmouthradio.org. And please tell your friends. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Spread it around and join us for more of Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.